Just wait a moment or two while we're transitioning from one case to the next. We had quite a few people for the first case here. So thank you, counsel, for your patience there. As I mentioned, this case is A18-1299 Integrity Insurance Company versus First Dakota Indemnity Company et al. Today is Tuesday, February 19th, 2019. Welcome, counsel. Counsel for appellant, you'll have 15 minutes for your initial arguments, then 15 minutes by respondent, and 5 minutes for rebuttal if you so choose. When you approach the podium, please state your name for the record and the party you're representing, and you may proceed, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
For the record, I'm Rick Stemple, and I represent Integrity Mutual Insurance Company, the appellant in this matter. May it please the court, counsel, and I'll get right to what I think's the prime issue here. Is this case covered by the Colonial Insurance Company case? And Judge Dawson said it was, and we had a motion hearing where we discussed that. And I've had other cases in front of Judge Dawson. She's excellent. She applied that law. I disagree with the application of the case for a specific reason. And I think Judge Dawson was very clear in her order at then when she said, as Integrity points out, this result leaves Integrity without recourse to pursue reimbursement from a workers' compensation carrier, regardless of whether or not the workers' compensation carrier has wrongfully denied coverage. So I'd like to backtrack to what happened here. Ms. Espinoza, the employee of White Gloves Cleaning, was in two motor vehicle accidents. And the first one was on March 21st of 2016. The second was October 10th of 2016. And at the time of the first accident, Ms. Espinoza's legal counsel submitted a claim to First Dakota. That claim was denied, at least in part, that on the basis that Ms. Espinoza was not in the course and scope of her employment. Now, that's never been adjudicated. A fellow named David Yata is the owner of White Gloves Cleaning, and he advised Integrity, his commercial auto carrier, that she was, in fact, in the course and scope of employment. But once the claim was denied, under Minnesota law, Integrity stepped up and provided no-fault benefits and made payments. Then when the second accident occurs, again, Ms. Espinoza's legal counsel submits a claim to First Dakota. This time, it's denied on the grounds of a pre-existing condition. And then, again, Integrity pays on the claim. And what we're really addressing here and go ahead.
How is this case distinguishable from the Colonial Insurance case, if at all? Because in this case, as in Colonial Insurance, in neither case was a petition filed with the workers' compensation division.
Understood. As I read Colonial, there was no claim even submitted to the work comp carrier.
But the crux of it is that there wasn't a decision as to workers' compensation coverage by the workers' compensation division or a workers' compensation judge. And that legal reasoning applies equally to this case.
It certainly can. The point is, we're saying that a district court judge is not capable of deciding whether somebody was in the course and scope of their employment. I just disagree with that. And I think that's why this case...
Are you asking us to overturn Colonial?
At least distinguish it, if not outright overturn it. I think it's wrongly decided because under 65B.61, work comp is definitely primary to no fault.
Well, the only thing, I mean, even if you could make an argument that we can overturn our own precedent.
Yes.
At Colonial cites to the Freeman case, Freeman v. Armour Food Company,
mm-hmm.
and I've got that case here, and that's a Supreme Court case.
Correct.
And in that case, they said basically that they note that the no-fault carrier has a right to intervene in a workers' compensation case to protect its reimbursement rights, but it also states very clearly, it should be noted that this is only a right to intervene. It should be noted that this that Chapter 176 does not give the no-fault carrier standing to initiate any claim petition on its own.
Mm-hmm.
And that was part of the basis, that whatever right the no-fault carrier has is derivative or dependent upon the workers' compensation matter being pursued by the employee.
Freeman does say that, Your Honor, and that's another impediment to our position, but the fact remains, we're now saying that work comp is, even though it's supposed to be primary, it's also supersedes no-fault law, which does give the no-fault carrier a right to reimbursement. So the catch-22 paradox that we find ourselves in is work comp supposed to be primary, but yet they can essentially deny a claim for any reason if a motor vehicle is involved, and that claimant will go to no fault, and there's no right for reimbursement, even if that's a wrongful denial.
Well, go ahead.
I'm sorry. Isn't that an issue for the legislature to address? The Colonial decision was decided in 1990, and the language was clear that it the last sentence is, therefore, while Colonial appears to be in a catch-22 paradox, the trial court correctly dismissed Colonial's action. And the whole basis for the action is based on the statutory language. So shouldn't that be an issue that's addressed by the legislature rather than by this court?
As I read the case decisions, it's based on the statutory language. I don't think the statute actually says that. That's the interpretation. And go ahead.
Wouldn't it have made sense to go to the legislature to clarify that in the intervening time?
Well, I don't have these gray hairs for anything. I've heard that many a time. The legislature should do something and nothing happens, regardless of the particular area.
Do you know if an effort was made at the legislature?
Pardon?
Do you know if an effort was made at the legislature in the intervening time?
I do not know that. But the fact remains, my client's been left without recourse. And what are they to do? We want claimants to have their no-fault claim denied and compelled to go file a work comp court action?
But your client is left without recourse because of the particular path that she took here.
That the claimant took?
Right. I'm sorry, that the claimant took.
Correct.
So, I mean, we're just an error correcting court, though. How can we don't have the authority to even given your consternation with the legislature not doing anything, that still doesn't imbue us with the ability to change that.
Right, but is this court saying it's satisfied with the fact that a no-fault carrier is compelled to pay benefits even if there's a wrongful denial by the work comp carrier, and then they're just left without any opportunity for reimbursement?
Well, I think we're looking at the fact that the Colonial decision did take that into account in its decision, and it's binding precedent on us unless we're given a very substantial reason as to why we should overturn our own precedent, particularly as Judge Hooten noted, that precedent is based on Supreme Court opinions.
The Freeman
as well.
Case, yes.
Right. So
let me point out something as far, because I said it should be distinguished. I think in Colonial, it involved the signed risk plan. And if you're familiar with no-fault law, the Supreme Court is also distinguished in the assigned claims plan for no-fault coverage. They're given rights that are in the statute that private insurers aren't. This claim for reimbursements against First Dakota, a private work comp insurer.
And I understand the frustration here, and I understand that there could be some abuses because of the no-fault carrier stepping in when the work comp carrier should step in. I understand that tension. But, I mean, the solution, is it this? Because you're basically coming to court on a subrogation claim, and you are in district court proving up, without the employee, a workers' comp claim. That certainly couldn't have been what was envisioned by these statutes. I mean, can you explain how that could be what was anticipated under the law?
Well, if I might address that, both of these claims ultimately had a no-fault arbitration, and there was a court reporter present at both, and the arbitrators gave leeway to ask about course and scope of the employment situation. And the, so there was testimony taken from the employee claimant that, in my opinion, made it clear she was in the course of scope of her employment. She could also be subpoenaed, and in fact, her legal counsel was involved early on in the case monitoring it.
Do you see the difficulty, though, that you're trying to prove up a workers' compensation claim when the party, the employee, is not even a party to the action?
I understand what Your Honor is saying, but she could be subpoenaed and give testimony on it. And Mr. Yata, the owner of White Gloves, was also planned to be a witness. And that's really the testimony that counts, what the business owner and the employee say about her job duties. It was clear from the arbitration testimony she had to come to White Gloves' office to pick up the day's cleaning schedule. That was a requirement of the job, and that's when these accidents happened. And I don't know if Your Honor noticed in our brief, her daughter was in the car at the time of the second accident, and First Dakota provided work comp benefits to her daughter.
But the second denial was on the basis of a pre-existing condition, correct?
Pre-existing condition.
Right.
Which we could talk for quite a while about the validity of that, but we have inconsistent results coming out of this case decision. From the Colonial case.
I mean, we don't know why the employee didn't pursue her workers' compensation claim before the Workers' Compensation Commission, but, should the no-fault carrier, maybe she didn't pursue it because she didn't think it was a good claim and she thought she'd lose. I mean, I don't know. But should the no-fault carrier be in a position where they're directing what the employee does or doesn't do in terms of what alternative claim they want to make?
Not directing, Your Honor, but I don't think the court would want, when we want people who are injured to get the applicable benefits, I don't think we want to permit a situation where a work comp carrier could literally say, oh, there's a vehicle involved, denied, for whatever reason, because nothing is likely to happen to them.
I understand your frustration as well, but as respondent pointed out, aren't there consequences to the work comp carrier if it wrongly denies a claim?
Not in this matter, and I was going to follow up with what Judge Hooten said. I think in a practical way, you have a path of least resistance. Once the work comp was denied after the claim was submitted to First Dakota, it's much easier to submit an application for benefits to the no-fault carrier, and they have 30 days to pay or deny, and you don't have to go through a court action. If there's any dispute, it's arbitrated, which is much quicker, much easier, less expensive.
Isn't this a situation where the legislature has made a determination about the two different processes, and based on the law, it seems clear that Colonial applies. So I'm not sure that we have an avenue to address your concern.
Well, that may...
As an error-correcting court.
I hear what the panel is saying, but I still...
Can you point to any, significant change circumstances since Colonial that would cause us to revisit the Colonial decision?
Well, I think I've distinguished it by the fact that there was an assigned risk plan involved rather than a private insurer, and I also would say that under 65B54, which has been amended in the year since 1990, Integrity is given a right of reimbursement in Subdivision 3. And so I guess a point for the court, if you don't think it's error to apply Colonial, then that's it. But if you think the fact that no-fault law says work comp's primary, and it further says the no-fault carrier is entitled to reimbursement, now we've just thrown that right out. We've made those no-fault statutes, we've rendered them meaningless. And I don't think that would be the intent of the legislature. Or why would they have enacted it?
So what statute do you believe makes this a different situation.
I think a combination of 65B61 and 65B54, subdivision 3, make it different.
And why?
Because otherwise you're destroying the legislative intent of having work comp be primary to the no fault, and you've destroyed the right to reimbursement on benefits paid or payable under 65B54 subdivision 3.
Wasn't that also the case in Colonial, though?
I think if subdivision or 65B54 has been amended a number of times. I do quite a bit of no fault work, and it's been amended and strengthened to give the no fault insurers a right to recover, especially as in the case of whether solicitation of insureds and things like that, and there's payments made.
I'm just looking at the Colonial case, and they do refer to that workers' compensation benefits paid or payable are primary to the no fault coverage. So that was in effect mm-hmm. at the time of the Colonial.
Yeah, and they as you pointed out, Your Honor, they relied on Freeman, but Integrity's position is they've effectively had any right of reimbursement destroyed, and that just doesn't seem to make common sense given the statutory framework. I'm out of time, so.
You'll have five minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Counsel for respondent, you have 15 minutes.
Thank you. May it please the court and counsel. I'm Mark Pryor. I represent First Dakota Indemnity. And I have a few things to discuss. The first issue, first and foremost, is this case falls squarely under Colonial. Judge Dawson's decision should be affirmed solely on that basis. This case is Colonial. We had that discussion at the time of the motion hearing, and that is exactly what this case is. I think to visualize this, you need to look at it a little bit through
Counsel, since you raised it, let's talk about that a little bit. The appellant argues that it's distinguishable because Colonial involved an assigned risk plan, and this case doesn't.
That's not a proper. We're talking about two different things. The Minnesota Workers' Compensation Assigned Risk Plan, which I represent often, is treated exactly in court like a private insurer. It is an insurer that is funded by assessments placed on insurers who don't want to write certain business. It's operated exactly like a private insurer. It's treated like a private insurer in all court cases. I've handled many of their cases, including appeals to this court. They're treated exactly the same. The Minnesota Assigned Claims Plan is a statutory creation in no-fault law, which is used for situations where there is no fault, assigned to a different company. Those are two different entities, and counsel's Integrity's confused them, but they're two different entities. The assigned risk plan and Colonial is treated exactly like a private insurer would be treated, always has been.
And that's distinguishable from the Minnesota Insurance Guarantee Association.
Right, which is it takes the place of defaulted insurers. The assigned claims plan, which I believe Integrity referred to, is the no fault plan that assigns an insurer to claims where there is no-fault policy written. So we're talking about two different things. But I think you need to look at this in terms of the lens of the claimant. The claimant has two options in this circumstance. They can assert a claim for workers' compensation benefits. They can assert a claim for no-fault benefits. Ms. Espinoza, in this case, had counsel through this entire process and made an informed decision in this case to pursue a no-fault claim.
I mean, here's the situation, though. I mean, a lot of these employees who have been injured on the job, they just want to get their medical expenses paid.
Sure,
and
absolutely.
Both systems provide for prompt payment,
yep,
correct?
That's absolutely true.
And if, in fact, if the workers' comp insurer says we're denying it,
right,
and they often do, and right, even when there's a denial,
right,
if it's pursued, they often lose.
Right. True.
Then the no-fault carrier's going to be disproportionately handling these claims.
That is not the case. The no-fault carrier and Integrity in this case paid exactly the benefits that they contracted for when they wrote that no-fault policy and accepted the premium for the no-fault policy. Nothing more, nothing less. Now, a couple of things. This, we keep hearing that there was a quote-unquote claim asserted for workers' compensation benefits. There was notice given of a potential claim. There was not a claim submitted. No different than if you're in an auto accident, you send a letter to the insurer or to the other party saying, I have this claim and I think you're responsible. If you don't do anything else, then you don't have, you haven't made a claim. In this case, there was notice given. There was a first report filed, which was filed by the employer, but that doesn't mean a claim has been made. In this case, Ms. Espinoza could still assert a workers' compensation claim should she choose to do so. She has not chosen to do so. She's chosen to take the path of going to obtain no-fault benefits. The no-fault insurer paid exactly the benefits that they're required to pay under their contract of insurance that they wrote for a no-fault policy. So I just don't understand the issue, the problem here.
Counsel,
and I want to say the other thing is, we keep hearing this, well, boy, if this happens, and then work comp carriers will be denying all these claims that there's a car involved. I'll tell you what, if this gets reversed, every time there's a no-fault claim and there's any indication that the employer is involved, that claim is going to get denied, guaranteed, because that's what we're going to see. That's not the situation here. And for whatever reason, Ms. Espinoza chose this route to take for her claim. She didn't go the route of the work comp claim. The work comp carrier issued a denial on the notice. They have the right to defend that should she bring the claim. She has not chosen to do so. She received the benefits that she applied for and could receive under that no-fault policy. It's just way, quite frankly, the system ought to work.
The statutory framework does provide that workers' compensation benefits are to be primary.
Absolutely.
And so how is this result consistent with that?
If both claims are made and the employee or claimant is entitled to benefits under both systems, and then that's determined, then yes, the workers' compensation benefits are primary if the claimant chooses to bring both claims. And they certainly can. She could bring a work comp claim, and there would be a question of coordination of benefits, just like there is in any other circumstances where we have multiple payers of benefits, whether it's medical insurance or no fault or whatever. We have, or work comp, we have those coordination systems, and that's what the statute provides. That's what 65B61 provides, is a coordination of benefits system if both claims are asserted. In this case, we simply don't have a workers' compensation claim asserted, so there is no primary, or which is primary because there's been no claim for the work comp benefits.
Is the result contrary to the legislature's intent then?
No, the intent is if the party is entitled to both claims, and we don't know if she is or not, she's never brought that claim. She's entitled to both, then there is a coordination. But if she's only entitled to one set of benefits and it's no fault, then that's the intent of the statute. I mean, it seems to me the system worked as it should. This case is right squarely under Colonial.
What about the argument of counsel that the statutory changes make this case distinguishable from Colonial?
I don't see anything in the statute that's changed that affects the statute's always said work comp primary, also said paid and payable. In this case, we don't have a paid because there's been no claim made. We don't have a payable because there's been no claim made to indicate what may be payable in the future. Nothing has changed that significantly alters this. That's the statutory scheme. Unless the court is nailed, I don't have anything else.
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court, I'd like to address some things that counsel said in his argument. And to the extent the court's familiar with no fault and the benefits provided, there is no fee schedule in work comp. There is no attorney fee schedule. No fault's really the last of the unregulated benefits, if you will, when it comes to injuries. And so, when counsel says, well, we don't know what the employee was thinking, Minnesota law is clear. The employee must first go to the work comp carrier. And that's exactly what the employee's attorney did. She submitted the claim.
Well, it's just a notice of claim. I mean, an employee may be submitting notices of a potential claim anytime they have any incident at work, just because that's required under their union contract or whatnot. I mean, that doesn't mean they're going to pursue the claim, right?
Agreed, but as soon as counsel for the employee got that denial letter, and there were denial letters issued by First Dakota on both accidents, then there was promptly an application for benefits submitted to Integrity for no-fault benefits. So that was the trigger, and Integrity paid and has paid pursuant to both those accidents, and I submit to you that that's the logical thing. If we were counsel for the employee claimant, we would submit a no-fault claim as soon as there's any rejection of the work comp because there's no limit or schedule on the benefits. And it's a much easier, much quicker process.
But isn't, again, getting back to Judge Cochran's question, isn't this a legislative issue? I mean...
Well, the panel may feel it's that way, but right now it's left my client without any recourse. And prior to the motion being made, we'd served discovery, including requests for admissions that were not responded to in a timely manner, and they never produced their claim file to support that they had a good faith basis for their denial. And to me, that's significant because that's why we have the Fair Claim Practice Act, which very much covers no-fault claims.
Well, could you explain to me, though, and again, looking at the underlying policies, why would it be a good underlying policy for a no-fault carrier to make the decision as to whether an employee pursues or doesn't pursue a workers' compensation claim? Why would that be a policy reason that the legislature would want to change this?
Well, Your Honor, I'm not advocating that the no-fault carrier control what the employee does or doesn't do, but once the employee makes that election to pursue no-fault, no-fault benefits are paid, I think it's fair for if the no-fault carrier can establish that it was an injury that occurred in the course and scope of employment.
Even though the employee, for whatever reason, didn't pursue it.
Correct.
That you're going to give that control to the no-fault carrier.
Well, I don't know that it's control, Your Honor. I might disagree with that terminology. But the fact is the claim gets submitted. It's already been denied by the work comp carrier.
Well, it's a notice. It's a statutorily required notice.
Okay.
It doesn't mean that, there's a lot, I mean, you'll agree that there's a lot of notices given by employees in any job of an incident. It doesn't mean they're going to pursue it, but they do so because they're required to do so by the law and maybe by their union.
Understood. There has to be a first report of injury and that sort of thing. But as soon as there was any rejection of the claim, it became a no-fault claim. And I'm not... I hope the court doesn't feel I'm saying the no-fault carrier should be in control and dictate to the employee and the employee's legal counsel what they do. We're simply saying, what about the issue of who was really primary on the claim? And right now the law is the no-fault carrier has no recourse if there's a wrongful denial. And that's something, you know, Judge Dawson felt was appropriate to put in the conclusion of her order.
Well, and she just mimicked the same language that was in Colonial by saying it's a catch-22.
Right, and my position or read is she went a little further to say it leaves them without any recourse, even if there's a wrongful denial. So that's what we're talking about as far as the issue here. I understand what the law is. I don't disagree with the panel. I just think it's manifestly unjust to clients like mine, the no-fault carriers. Thank you.
Thank you both, counsel. We will be issuing an order on this within the 90-day statutory time frame.
Okay.
Thank you both.
Thank you.
And thank you to the students for attending. Hopefully, we're able to get something out of it. Good morning. The next case on our calendar is A18-0860. I have counsel are present for that one. You can step up. Is your opposing counsel here, do you know?
Not to my knowledge. I haven't seen them outside.
I think I saw him. Let me find him.
Okay, thank you. Marshall, we'll be taking a quick break while we're waiting to hear from counsel. Let us know when both counsel are here.